the first bill, and these all the bills we're going to hear today are just for public hearing. Senate Bill 203A. Ray, you want to tell us what it does?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 203A increases the membership of the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board from 7 to 8 members by adding a certified veterinary technician. It changes the title of the executive secretary to the executive director and deletes the grandfather clause for those veterinarians licensed under prior laws of the state. It also deletes reference to the Department of Human Resources.
Thank you. And we'll call. Lori Macklin.
Good. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon,
Mr. Chair and members. I'm Lori Macklin. Director, former Executive Secretary, soon hoping to be Executive Director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, and I'm here basically to answer any questions you have about this
position.
Mr. Chair?
I just got tuned in. Did you already testify, Laura?
I did.
How many I
have? Last
time. Repeat it.
We remember. It's not like you weren't memorable.
You want me to just repeat what I just said?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Lori Macklin, director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, and I'm here primarily just to answer any questions that you have about this.
That helps.
Okay, now we have questions. Yes, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Is it Macklin?
How do you Macklin. I think
how do you spell your name?
M-A-K-I-N-E-N.
M-A-K-I-N-E-N?
Yes.
And your first name?
Lori, L-O-R-I.
L-O-R-I. Lori, Mr. Chair and Lori, what is happening to the current director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I am the current director, but the language called my title Executive Secretary, and I thought this was an opportune time since we were changing other things in the statute to bring the name up to consistency with job description and also to boost my self-esteem a little.
Further questions?
Yes, a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
So is there an expense to this increased membership to 8 members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, there is an increase. It's it's about $2,500 biennium.
About what?
$2,500. It's a little less than $2,500. It covers the per diem and the stipend for the additional member.
And last follow-up, Mr. Chair, very quickly. And the primary purpose of this board is to approve or remove veterinarians. Is that true?
Pretty much, in a nutshell, that's it.
And what would be your credentials?
Oh, for my position?
Uh-huh.
I have a bachelor's degree in public administration, certificate in human resources management. I have 15 years of state service. I'm semi-enrolled in the Portland State University Master of Public Administration program. And I'm not a veterinarian.
And the makeup of the board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we have 5 veterinarians currently and 2 public members.
That are non-veterinarians?
Not veterinarians.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes.
I just have one.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair Gilman. Thank you. Why would we need the increase? Maybe would be the question.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Smith. There's a bill that has been proposed that would require certified technicians to report continuing education. The board felt that concurrent with that effort to professionalize that field, we wanted to give them a voice on the board. It's also pretty much standard across the country that technicians are members on boards where they're regulated by those boards.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Lori.
Is that Monica?
No, Marcia.
Marcia?
Okay. Marcia Keith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marcia Keith. I'm with Dave Barrows and Associates, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. This is the group that is regulated by the board, the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, which has proposed this bill. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the OVMA, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, in support of Senate Bill 203. We particularly believe that the addition of a veterinary technician to the board has merit, particularly in light of the fact that we're asking them to participate in continuing education, so that they should have a voice in how that continuing education is regulated and administered. So I just wanted to say that we support the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Anyone else that would like to testify on 203A? Close the hearing. And open the hearing on Senate Bill 204.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 204 authorizes the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board to take evidence, take depositions of witnesses, compel appearance of witnesses, require answers to interrogatories, compel production of documents and files, and issue subpoenas during the course of an investigation. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ray. Lori and Monica, you want to come back up? Well, both of you come at the same time, I think.
Good afternoon, Representative Gilman and members of the committee. I'm Lori Makinen, Director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board. The board has proposed this legislation primarily in order to add a couple of tools to our kit to enforce the veterinary practice act, and also to give the board pretty much the standard investigative powers that regulatory boards have in the state.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure this is. I probably should just invite you up to my office and talk to you. How do you? How does the board? Supervise physicians that are, or veterinarians that are starting to work in alternative types of practice. I actually have a dog that's going through acupuncture now, and one of the vets in the practice is doing chiropractic work also on animals.
Dr. Dillman, Representative Byer.
Yes, why?
The Practice Act doesn't make a distinction between traditional or what they call alternative methods, other than a reference to people who practice alternative methods may do so under the with a referral from a veterinarian, but that refers to people who are not veterinarians.
Right.
So we have, in the last 6 years, we've designated a member who is sort of our point person on alternative meds, and that's Dr. Bob Anderson in Portland, and he's attended some of the big international conferences on alternative or complementary veterinary medicine. And we're also working with a group that's called, another acronym for you, IOP, the International Alliance for Animal Therapy and Healing, and what they're doing is trying to establish a sort of a database or a clearinghouse where alternative practitioners, both veterinarians and others who work on animals, will have to meet certain criteria, have proper credentialing, and then be registered in this clearinghouse. One of the problems that the board has is that nobody on the board now has expertise in any alternative method, and it's difficult for to assess the quality of alternative care. What we do if we have a complaint is we locate an alternative practitioner and ask them to act as a consultant to sort of walk us through what's going on.
Thank you.
Well, Lori, I have a question on these tools that, I mean, how do you carry on investigations now if you aren't using some of these?
Chair Gilman and members, it's in order to get a subpoena at this point, what we have to do is have our AG go before a judge and get one. And in the 6 years that I've been there, we did this once with a particularly egregious case. With the time that was involved, getting, first of all, paying our AG $96 an hour to go before a judge and all that stuff, we lost some time in a very important case. I want to point out, though, that this, what we're asking for... Oh, wait, your question is how do we do anything without these...
Yeah.
I guess people don't know that we really don't have the authority. We do have authority to do a number of things. What we're asking for here, I think, is the only thing that really expands what we're doing, what we have the authority to do already, is issue subpoenas.
Okay.
And this makes it also, this particular thing, coupled with OBMA's bill that would give us civil penalty authority, is going to make it easier for the board to address situations of unlicensed practice. In other words, people that don't have veterinary licenses that are practicing. We'll be able to issue the subpoena. There has been concern, I know, on the part of the veterinary community that this, makes us a more big and powerful board, which I find amusing. But we already have the authority to compel anything that we need to in a disciplinary situation from our licensees. So this is primarily to give us a little more authority to go after people that are harming animals without a license.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Lori and Marcia. Isn't there a difference between compel and require? I'm just amazed you use, both terminology in this bill, and I think we need to, in both of these related bills, we need to decide which one we're using. To me, require is a, you have the right to require, is an absolute. But you may compel mm-hmm. is something that is not an absolute. I'm just curious because I think that's, we need to wordsmith this a little better.
Chair Gilman, Representative Nelson, that's a good point, and I don't know the answer to it. I think possibly the Legislative Council needs to take a look at it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would suggest that that question be directed toward our legal experts. My sense is there's probably some sort of legal distinction between require and compel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further questions?
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe you can answer it or they can answer it. It seems that your expansion here is quite substantial to me, so I guess I'm just concerned as to what you think is the problem we're trying to fix.
Chair Gilman, Representative Smith, the problem is unlicensed practice. Of veterinary medicine.
Of veterinary.
People who aren't veterinarians are advertising themselves as healers.
Mm-hmm.
We had a conference a group, a splinter group of IOP came to one of our board meetings, and there is a range of non-veterinary practitioners that work on animals, and all the, you know, anywhere from acupuncture, which is a legitimate, I mean, it, the board recognizes that as a legitimate modality, but at the other end of the spectrum, we had a shamanistic healer, and there's no way for a lay person or a client to determine whether or not that modality is doing any good for the animal, or more importantly, is harming the animal. I don't know that shamanistic healing would really do harm, but on the other hand, we have people that are that have taken a 9 or 12 week correspondence course and are practicing animal chiropractic. And there's just no way that you can learn how to do animal chiropractic in a 9 week correspondence course.
Follow up?
Yes.
Is the advertising the key then? Because it says complaint of any citizens. So could a person complain that the neighbor came over and helped them with their animal, and now all of a sudden you're involved?
Chair Gilman, Representative Smith, that is, I think, a very unlikely scenario, because the board has discretion over whether or not to pursue something like that. I'll give you an example of a situation that we probably wouldn't go into, and part of the reason that some of this stuff came up is I call them my dueling pet sitters in Lake Oswego. As part of their service, they will administer medications to animals, and one of the competitors reported the other one to the board and said she's practicing veterinary medicine. So we looked at them and said, well, you know, maybe, maybe not. If the client, this isn't a situation where a lot of harm can be done, and I don't think that this is the kind of thing that the board would expend any time or resources on going after. On the other hand, somebody, we have one right now, I can't remember where he's located. It's another thing where he's been through a correspondence course and is advertising his services as a, not a naturopath, let's say a homeopathic animal healer. And that came to our attention because the client had a dog that had some eye problems, and this homeopath gave them some cream to put on the eyes. And then the dog also had a problem at the other end, and the homeopathic healer said, well, you can use this at either end. And the person thought that sounded a little funny, so he consulted with his veterinarian. It turned out that it should not have been used for either end at all. It was, you know, something that could have done more harm. That's, in a situation like that, I think the board would, you know, look into it, use these tools to try to do something about it. But, you know, we certainly use discretion in what we go after. We don't have a lot of money to do it in the first place, and it doesn't make any sense to, you know, use a big hammer to go after a pet sitter who's giving a cat a pill.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori, do you have input to the board?
Chair Gilman, Representative Nelson, I have more input than they like, I think, at times. My role is not in advising them on the clinical or technical aspects of veterinary medicine. What I do is, if they want to do something particular, take a particular action, I tell them whether or not it's lawful, legal, wise, advised, ill-advised.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. And is there a difference in salary of the executive secretary and the executive director?
Representative Gilman, Representative Nelson, no. There's no money involved in that. It's just makes me sound more important.
Okay.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, excuse me, just, yeah. just a quick follow-up. How many complaints have we had in this last year?
Chair Gilman, Representative Nelson, we get an average of 10 to 12 a month. So whatever that, you know, 120, 130.
And what is the primary issue?
Like
most prevailing issue?
The most prevailing issue that we hear about is money. So of those dozen or so 120 a year, maybe 5% of them end up being jurisdictional and worthy of any kind of disciplinary attention.
You say money issues. Excuse me.
Fees.
You get complaints that the fees are too high?
Yeah.
And what are the fees?
Excuse me?
What, I mean, you mean fees for offices?
For veterinary
surgery. For surgery, different types of surgery.
Right.
I see.
And we don't regulate fees or business practices. Another complaint we get a lot is that the veterinarian doesn't have the right attitude or show compassion, and that's also something that we don't regulate.
Yes. And this is my good time to use my good knowledge I learned this morning about the hearing panel. Does an individual bring this case to the Oregon hearing panel for consideration? They don't have to pay legal bills then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the central hearing officer panel, if that's what you're referring to, is where just about all state agencies are required to have their cases heard at. And a citizen with a complaint first goes to a board.
Oh.
And then the board looks at that complaint if it's jurisdictional. And then if the board finds discipline and the veterinarian chooses to request a contested case hearing, at that point, the board and the veterinarian would go to the central hearings office.
Oh,
okay. Panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representing Nelson, Legislative Council's here. Maybe
you'd
like to address that question, if you don't mind coming up. State your name.
Chair Gilman, my name is Charles Cheek. I'm a Deputy Legislative Counsel, and that's your
thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Cheek, it's very compelling that you should come here.
I think I'm required.
You are required to be here. I'm glad you were compelled, but you were not required, right? Could you tell us the difference? I'm surprised in this House bill, or Senate bill 204, you know, we're requiring in one place and we're compelling in the other, and I don't think compel has legal standing footing.
Well, compel has a legal meaning, which means to urge forcefully.
Right.
Require is a requirement.
Right.
Okay, that's self-explanatory, I think. What urge forcefully means in terms of a legal consequence, I think if you look at that whole subsection 2, is really explained by F, which says that the board may issue subpoenas. So if a forceful urging doesn't achieve the result that the board would desire, they could issue a subpoena ducis tecum to require those documents to be produced.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Well, then why do we say we're requiring answers to interrogatories, but yet the people aren't even there? Because they've been compelled, but we're requiring answers, but they're compelled.
I mean, most of these board authorities are drafted in terms of convention, and the language is sort of common to all the boards. And I don't know where it came back and saying, instead of saying all be requirements, for example, as opposed to a compulsion. But I think, like I said, the real authority lies in if the board requests you to produce documents, they're compelling you to produce documents, they say, bring these documents, these files, and you don't do it, they can obtain them legally through the issuance of a subpoena, which is enforceable in court.
But follow up, Mr. Chair, we could avoid that if we just require in C&E, right?
Well, even Representative Nelson, even if the board can require the production of documents, what happens if you don't produce the documents? The board still has to issue a subpoena to get you to have a legally enforceable obligation to bring them.
Oh.
See, so it's the vehicle is really the subpoena power. I think it's an understanding of cooperating with a statutory created body with responsibilities. If they are requiring you to do something, it would be in your interest to do it, or you're going to be faced with a subpoena to do so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, this committee doesn't see the dozens of other health licensing board authorities, so we're,
right.
To some degree, we're trotting new ground for us here, I think, at least for me. Are there elements of this that you would say differ from the typical health professional licensing board, or is it fairly fairly standard cookie cutter.
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, no, I think this is fairly standard authority. The board, a regulatory board, would have this authority. That's considered in general necessary to implement the statutes they have the duty to enforce. Okay.
Further questions? Thank you very much for taking the time to come down here. And Marcia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Marcia Keith with Dave Barrows and Associates, representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 204. The Oregon Veterinary Medical Association feels that the provisions in Senate Bill 204 give necessary authority to the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, and we'd like to go on record in support of the bill.
Questions? Thank you very much, both of you. Close the hearing on 204, Senate Bill 204, and open the hearing on Senate Bill 241A.
What happened to Ray?
Well, guess who? Oh, here he is. I'm sorry. How about a summary, Ray? 241A.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 241A extends the sunset by 2 years for Department of Agriculture civil penalties imposed for quarantine order violations, control area violations, failure to timely pay timber products health program fee, acting as an unlicensed nursery stock grower, dealer, or agent, and acting as an unlicensed Christmas tree grower. Mr. Chair, members of the committees, under 1999 session laws, the State Department of Agriculture was given the ability to impose civil penalties up to $10,000 for violation of a department quarantine order, rule, or regulation. The department's civil penalty authority sunsets on December 31st, 2003. This Senate Bill 241A, extends that authority for an additional 2 years.
Thank you. And Chuck Craig and Don Hallberg from the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Craig. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Agriculture, and with me is Dan Hilburn, the Administrator of our Plant Division. Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 241A was the department introduced to make our civil penalty authority for these violations permanent. However, the Christmas tree industry felt more comfortable if we were to just extend the sunset for another 2 years to be sure that things were working out okay before we decided to go permanent. So that's the reason that this bill has been amended since the original piece was introduced. This is a very important tool in our toolbox for enforcing laws that protect Oregon's agriculture, forestry, horticultural industries. And the problems that are addressed by quarantines, licensing laws, and the imported timber health program continue to increase as global trade and commerce exposes our industries to more and more threats of dangerous pests that can be introduced that would cause great economic damage to the state. So we originally introduced a bill to grant this authority to the department because we had no authority other than criminal prosecution with a fine of $75 or something like that for the violation of the nursery licensing laws. And this has proven to be very effective. We've used this authority formally 6 times. We've been able to obtain compliance each time without actually going all the way to the civil penalty, which we regard as a great success, actually, of being able to get people to go along with the law without having to assess a penalty, and numerous times informally where we've just told people, look, you know, the penalty for not having a license is more than it costs to have a license. Why don't you just get one? Everybody will be happy. So, Mr. Chair, Dan has some examples, if you'd like us to maybe go through one so you can see how this process works. It might be just do one.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dan Hilburn. I'm administrator of the plant division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'll give you one example. This is from a Umatilla County control area, which basically requires people within the control area to maintain their orchards to keep their pests in under control. So you can't abandon an orchard in this control area because that would act as a breeding ground for pests. And we had a grower in the area who in May and June of 2000 didn't do any insect control, failed to put on any other control measures, and trap catches in and around his orchard indicated that the coddling moth population was very high. He received a notice to control those pests or to remove his orchard, and in June of that year, he did put on a spray, and then trap catches in July and August indicated that they had worked. The following spring, in May and June of 2001, he once again failed to put on any cover sprays. Trap catches were very high again in his orchard. And in August, he was delivered another notice to take care of his problems. He refused to do that, and that's when we went ahead with the proposed imposition of a civil penalty. He requested a hearing, and we went through that process, and in the end, he finally cut down all those trees and removed it. So before we ever collected the civil penalty, he took care of the problem. But I think this is a good example. Is if we hadn't had that hammer, he was prepared to ignore us.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Hilburn, would he be responsible for the spread of this, whatever this moth was, whatever it was? I mean, how is that taken care of? Do you assess a cost for that too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, if you mean, does his orchard act as a nursery, which then causes a problem for his neighbors? That is true. So, yes, he's responsible for causing pest problems in neighboring orchards.
And is he assessed, what I ask, and then do the assessing of the damage to the neighbors, since he had to cut his orchard down, do you also assess what of the neighbors now has to be cut down also? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the neighbors are all taking care of their orchards, so they are able to protect their apples and prevent problems.
Okay.
But because you have somebody who's not taking care of their orchard, it requires extra work, extra expense for those neighbors to keep their apples healthy.
And he's not charged for that?
He is not.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From the agency standpoint, what is the advantage of continuing to have a sunset date in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, as I mentioned earlier, we sought to just eliminate the sunset and go permanent. The Christmas tree industry, and I think there's a representative here from that industry who may want to speak to you about, felt more comfortable continuing the sunset for another 2 years just to be sure that the program was working out in a manner that's acceptable to their industry. I think they, there's a significant amount of concern that regulatory authority by agencies turns into something that you're sorry you created at some point, and folks want to be sure that the agency's managing this authority well, and they'd like to go another couple years to make sure.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question just for educational purposes for me.
How do you determine a control area? Use that, a control unit? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we set the control area by a process very similar to administrative rulemaking after a technical analysis has taken place by people that are versed in the science of whatever the issue is that's connected with the control area, a certain kind of pest, if it's an insect or if it's an invasive weed or a plant disease or something. People that are specialists in that area analyze the issue, use the best science that is available to determine what kind of an area is necessary to be protective. And then we go through a process with public hearings and so forth to establish that area and put it into rule. Essentially, it's a statutory process similar to rulemaking. And eventually, when very detailed measures are developed for that area, we do put those in administrative rule, but quarantines and control area orders initially are done by a slightly different process. But there is public input and a process for everyone to know what's going on.
Thank you. Follow-ups?
Yes.
One more question then. As you know, where I live in East Multnomah County, where we have a tremendous problem with noxious weeds. And my question is, why are agencies exempt from having the same things that the private, you know, you're putting a quarantine and stuff here, but in our area, agencies are exempt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know that they are exempt. Dan, can you shed some light on that?
Chair and Representative Smith, is this a part of a weed district?
No. Well, I don't know if it is. I just know we have tansy ragwort everywhere, and it's increasingly growing. And I hear a lot about the noxious weed problems in eastern Oregon.
Well, let me add a little bit to what Chuck said about the control areas. They don't work for everything. They're especially good for pests that require a regional approach. If you and I live close to each other and I have a problem that I don't mind but you really do mind, you try to control it, but it doesn't do you any good because it's always migrating from my property to yours, then that's where a control area makes sense. You have the people, the landowners, working together to control the problem. But there are other issues, other weeds, other pests where they don't work, and we don't use that tool.
Okay.
Further questions?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Both.
Chuck and Dan. Okay. Scott Astrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Scott Astrom, today representing the Oregon Agriculture Alliance, which is a coalition of large growers in the Willamette Valley and statewide in Oregon. We support Senate Bill 241A. In fact, we supported Senate Bill 241, which is the permanent recognition of civil penalties to the department. I don't want to take any more time than just to elaborate something that has not yet been discussed, except tangentially, which is one of the real advantages to having a strong civil penalty authority in ODA. Many of our members are large nursery growers, and as you probably know, the nursery industry in Oregon exports from 70 to 80% of its nursery stock out of state and out of country. To have a credible plant safety and health program with teeth, enforcement powers in the hands of the Department of Agriculture is a real advantage to growers who export plant material from the state of Oregon. It gives the Department of Agriculture credibility in the eyes of other state departments of agriculture. It gives the Department of Agriculture credibility in the eyes of other national departments of agriculture because they know that if the Department of Agriculture's got a good, strong enforcement program with teeth that it can rely on to compel compliance with plant health and safety standards, it knows that It can depend on the integrity of a Oregon Department of Agriculture quarantine in the state. Just to give you an example, sudden oak death was discovered on some property in the South Coast not too long ago. Sudden oak death disease is a disease which can also infect rhododendrons in addition to oak and whatever other varieties that it infects. Well, rhododendrons, of course, are a nursery plant species which are exported from many of the nurseries in the Willamette Valley. And Canada, once a sudden oak death disease was discovered in Oregon, imposed a quarantine against the exportation out of the state or into Canada of rhododendrons. You see, ODA, however, had a strong plant safety and health and safety inspection program backed up by adequate enforcement powers and civil penalties. Recognizing this, Canada lifted its quarantine, and our growers are able to send their stock there. So that's one of the things which has not been mentioned yet about why a good, solid program of this is in the interest of growers, and we support 241, and we support its continuation.
Thanks, Scott. Questions? No? Thank you much. Sean Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Pacific Northwest Christmas Tree Association, and we are here today in support of Senate Bill 241. We did request amendment on the Senate side, which did extend the sunset another 2 years, and to go straight to Representative Hunt's question of why extending it 2 years instead of just eliminating the sunset altogether. And I'll go back to 1999. We did support the ability in giving the department the ability to issue civil penalties for quarantine issues, unlicensed Christmas tree growers and nursery folks. But we wanted to give the department the ability to see how it worked, see how they were going to use it. And at that time, we came back in 2001, and they wanted to eliminate it, but the program hadn't got started yet. They actually just started to write the rules in 2001, so we didn't get a good indication at that time of how the program was working. Since then, the rules have been put in place. We extended it another 2 years to give the department the ability to look at it, and they've done, as was indicated, about 6 cases. They have been successful. It's every indication that things are going well, but it's still a very young program. Even though the bill was created in 99. And so we would like to pass Senate Bill 241, extend this out another 2 years, and I would suspect that next session, hoping everything goes fine, that we'll be back to eliminate it at that point. But at this time, again, the program's still young. We want to make sure that they're using it effectively. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Yes.
I appreciate that initial explanation. I guess my question is, in this time when we've got such greatly diminished resources, frankly, I hate to see us pull him in here rather than, you know, and pull him in 2 years again for another extension or permanence then, rather than have him out doing his job. I guess that's my concern on a lot of these sunset provisions. Which is why I've supported some on voting on the other the other end of things, just because I don't understand in a lot of cases why we have these continual sunset provisions, force all these agency staff in there, therefore that limit their ability to serve, in this case, your clients, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe give me some additional guidance.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, it's a good point. However, there is an advisory council to the Christmas Tree Advisory Council that works real close with Mr. Hilburn. And when this was created, they wanted the agency to go out because there was problems out there. And at the time, again, it didn't happen in the first couple of years. And so from our standpoint, we want them to be utilizing, and we want them to be utilizing the civil penalty authority. However, Unless they are working with the industry on shaping how they're going to use that. I know, and I'm not saying, and this is not a distrust to the Department of Agriculture, because they do work very closely with the industry, and we do appreciate and are partners with them on this endeavor. However, if they are not doing something that's appropriate with this authority, because this is a pretty extensive authority when you're talking about $10,000 civil penalty, and so we want to make sure that they're using that appropriately. And at this point, 2 years, six cases, and they've never issued a civil penalty. We'd like the 2 years, and we'd like to see them even go further and how they're going to use this, see how the civil penalty is worked. We do feel that it's been successful since one hasn't been issued. However, in some cases, probably some should be issued. And I think we want to see how that works when they are issued. And at that point, again, Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, I think you won't see a problem with the industry. It's just we want to make sure we're doing the right thing here. And that's why we encourage the two-year sunset.
Other questions? Thank you. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Anyone else for Senate Bill 241? Close the hearing. And open the hearing on 242A, Ray.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 242A comes to us. It allows the State Department of Agriculture employees to inspect and certify processes used in connection with horticulture and agricultural products. It authorizes the department to adopt rules, add seeds, bulbs, and tubers that are not nursery stock to the definition of horticulture and agricultural products, allows the department to collect fees for the additional inspection and certification services. It specifies the fees and charges that must be deposited in the Department of Agriculture Service Fund to be continuously appropriated to the department for enforcement of related inspection statutes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 242A declares an emergency effective on passage and does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Ray. Chuck, Jim, and John, come on up. And John, I'm anxious to find out how to pronounce that last name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Chuck Craig, Deputy Director for Department of Agriculture. With me is Jim Kramer, Administrator of our Commodity Inspection Division, and John Schipinski, who is our Assistant Director for our Marketing Program. Mr. Chair, the very simple purpose of this bill is to give us the clear-cut legal authority to certify processes, entire processes. We have had the ability to certify commodities, such as grade A potatoes or whatever, for some time. However, in the marketplace now, there is a need to be able to certify an entire process. Many buying entities now are using the existence of that certification as part of their decision to purchase or not a product. So that is really what this bill is intended to do, and I'm going to have my colleagues explain what it's about in a little more depth.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Schipinski, Assistant Director with the agency. I oversee the marketing division, and our job is to help promote Oregon products. And it's one of the strengths of Oregon agriculture that we do have such fine products. But it's also that our strength also lies in how we raise our agricultural products. And increasingly, in the world market, as well as in our domestic markets, those markets that are very critical for our continued strength, people are asking questions about the products that they're buying, questions about where their products were grown and how their products were grown or processed and by whom, these are becoming part of the decision matrix, the questions that our customers are being asked. And so the company that can answer these questions has a competitive edge. It gives them market access. In some cases, it's simply what they need to get into a store. In other cases, it helps provide higher margins and hence gives them a chance to differentiate their products and to take credit for the good work that they're doing, not just being able to produce and sell good products, but also to take advantage and to promote the way that they grow those products. And so this is a market reality. And our customer base have asked for that added level of service that we can then verify by a third party means the way the products are grown or handled or processed, and this third party verification by an official source carries a tremendous amount of weight domestically, but probably even more so internationally, where foreign governments are involved in the buying matrix as well. And having that certification, that third-party verification being offered by a government entity, just adds the extra cachet and the extra integrity that helps get our products noticed and accepted in the foreign markets. And I think Mr. Kramer will talk a little bit more about the how as opposed to the why.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Kramer, and I'm the administrator of the Commodity Inspection Division. This division will be the ones that will actually be performing the audits and, in many cases, producing the audits for our customers. I would like to say that it is a voluntary program, and actually the agricultural industries that we service compelled us to get involved. They're the ones that came to us through our different advisory committees and asked us to get prepared, able to provide them with these services. So it was our response to that to get us to this point where we're at today. The requests for us to produce these matrices to verify these processes is increasing every day, and it the nuts and bolts would be identity preserved would be an example of that. Auditing for someone's practices for secured storage, bioterrorism kinds of things, even as simple as a company verifying their own weights of products being shipped. These types of services is what we're talking about in this program, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions, Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kramer, Mr. Zapinski, Mr. Craig, of course. I'm concerned in that we cannot even establish the definition of science. Dear God, in this state, how on earth we're going to be able to give any identity to any of these processes? One. And secondly, what are we comparing them to? I mean, you know, if you're evaluating them by grade, like you say in the bill, grade and quantity and quality and all of this, uh-huh. You know, who has established what is, you know, a grade, you know, AAA? I hope it's not another country's criteria.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm glad you asked that question, because what it really is a voluntary program that the company decides what they want verified. So it might be things like their good agricultural practices, which are steps that they have taken to reduce microbial contamination on their products. And good handling practices, which is the same in the packaging side of things. Identity-wise, they may want to track ways of production along the lines of water use. It could be vitamin A-enriched rice. It could be any process that they would want tracked. So it's not regulatory in any fashion, and it's up to the producer or the handler and kind of their imagination what could they use and implement that the department could officially verify that they might use for this market advantage or, in many cases, just market retention.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Let me maybe explain why I have great concern here is that we have gone through this numerous times in our area of organic versus non-organic. Now, you know, my concern is that your evaluation is going to identify my competitor's product, which is organic, as superior to mine. I'm going to be very upset with you and sue the Department of Agriculture in this state. And, you know, also give you a bill for the loss of my market. Those are categories. I have that already that exists in my area substantially. And, you know, I'm in the heart of this beautiful Willamette Valley. I have, what do I have, 156 vineyards there, you know, and you're going to come and compare each one to what? Their products. I'm just trying to get this through to you.
Okay.
Because we have this mass of products that exist in our valley. And, you know, I'm assuming that the individuals are going to want to use this as, Mr. Zapensky said, as a marketing tool. But here where you have all these competitors in the same valley using the same soil, you know, maybe they apply a few different chemicals or don't use any. I mean, I think I'd be curious to know how you're going to develop this rating system.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, in some cases, the rating system that you potentially see, it exists with U.S. Department of Agriculture on the grade thing. I think that probably it's more easy for us to compare an established standard called U.S. number one against U.S. number two or a cull or something along those lines. That's easy for us to compare because that's what we've been doing for 100 years.
Right.
In the area of certifying processes, it falls more in line with those very same products, but it's not exclusive to them. So we're not in the position to develop standards for comparing other products. We're being asked to audit the company or the processor's processes that they've put in place. I'm not sure if I'm getting exactly where you want, but...
No, you're not. Mr. Chair, follow up. It's like anything else. You know, whether we're pretty or not pretty, or but we have some. You know, we're handsome or not handsome. But I mean, we have some comparison in our mind. We have some set standard for everything we do that we evaluate. In aviation, if it's on time service, in flight service, those sort of things. So I'm just concerned about what process, and it would be very helpful to me if we could see a concept, you know, of how it's developed, and I'm just recommending this for the future, Mr. Chair, because, to me, it could be as harmful as it could be advantageous.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, one of the key process matrices has been developed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. What they call good handling and good ag practices. This is actually an audit program based on a set of guidelines that was issued in the late 1990s, as Jim mentioned, to limit microbial hazards. And so there is a very defined checklist of different aspects of the growing and handling processes. With training that's conducted nationally for these auditors, they're looking at very specific aspects of the process. For example, it's to make sure that if employees are coming in contact with product, that there is some process that they're washing their hands, and that the employer has a system in place just to check whether or not there is adequate facilities there with clean water for their hands to be washed. There is a matrix of 70 questions that are fairly standardized, and in that sense it's a
So Mr. Chair, may we request Mr. Zimpansky a copy of this document you're going to use to rate people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, we can.
Right. So maybe help me understand it better.
Mr. Chair, if I might try to add some explanation to this. Primarily what we're seeking to do here is verify a process of production, not necessarily rate a product. The rating systems or the grades and standards that we use are developed primarily by USDA. And what we're doing here principally is conducting an audit that verifies or confirms that a particular product was produced according to protocols that the buyer wants to be able to have documentation that what he's buying was produced in this fashion, and in the end that he's getting what he thinks he's paying for because it was produced that way. It's I don't think that we're saying that these products are necessarily superior to another product as much as we are providing a verification that it was produced in a certain way that the buyer wants to have some assurance that it really was. Because how would they know unless an independent third party conducted an audit and certifies that it was done that way?
Mr. Chair, just a final remark. So to me, this is like getting the stamp, the Good Housekeeping stamp of approval. But I just have to tell you that in my heart, I really am concerned because, for example, in the growing of apricots, I wanted to brag, but I won't, or potatoes. Well, I'm just saying that if I don't participate in your program and my competitor does, so Japan buys his product, what you're doing is you're requiring everybody has to participate if they're going to be able to sell their commodities somewhere else. And I'd rather them just know that the good old USA is the best brand to buy and buy beef from, USA beef, and rather than us have these confrontational situations within the state among our growers. Just haven't been there.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. Actually, in a lot of cases, these are conditions or processes already being asked by the marketplace. There are requirements where to sell fresh fruits and vegetables to Albertsons or Safeway within the United States that they are asking for some third-party verification of practices being conducted on the farm or in that packing shed that help to limit their liability in the case of any sort of foodborne illness. And so it's a ticket into the game in a sense, but it's not saying that that the department is actually creating the bar. In a sense, the bar is actually being set by the customer, and the retailer, having asked for that, is having then the producer come to us, as many have done and continue to do, as Jim said, asking for the department to provide that integrity-filled third-party verification that the market is already asking for.
Mr. Chair, I promise I won't even ask another question. If you'll just let me ask.
No, I'm going to check and make sure if I have any other members
that
want to answer. Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. So this is a voluntary, and it's the producer who's going to ask you to do this. So it helps them.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right, reading that right?
That's correct.
That's all I want to know.
Does this tie in with branded beef like Oregon Trail? Will they come to you and ask to be...
Yes, Mr. Chair, they very well could.
Okay.
now, or if there's anything else.
Well, I was just going to say, and I'm glad Representative Smith asked the question, because that's not exactly true. It's not exactly true that this is a benefit to the producer. Because what you do is you buy the rating, buy the quality of the grading, you put them in a price fixing. For example, by your rating, by what you say you do, whether it's I wanted to use Del Monte and Hunt ketchup. I happen to know this because my husband's an agronomist pomologist. But you know, by what you do, and it can taint your whole situation for a lifetime. I mean, it can really impact you, because you have, for individuals who feel that certain steps are necessary, there's a price. A corresponding price increase. And so when you start rating individuals and you're telling Albertson, so they say, well, if they're only leaving out this one step, you know, we'll buy these tomatoes at, you know, 32 cents a pound. And I think we're doing this to the disadvantage of the grower. I haven't been there as of only recently. I don't even know how to explain it, and I guess I'm doing a lousy job, so I'll shut up.
No, I don't think so. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, you have a point, and it's not that we haven't heard that very same thing. But the truth is that the Albertsons, the Krogers, the Fred Meyers, the Costcos, the Ciscos, the Norpacs, the Quests, the many people that we have right here in Oregon processing and handling the food are the very ones that are requiring it of the growers. It's not an option for them. And for them to get that service, they have, in some cases, a choice. The choice might be to fly someone from Switzerland out here, or from Europe, or from another state, or from across the state, and it's an undue hardship on our producers and our handlers of the process. And that's why, in some cases, it has the effect where someone that is not or unwilling to have some of the processes done will not be able to market to those companies, like I previously mentioned, because they are not going to accept them. The risk associated with microbial contamination, which is the biggest one, is great enough in the eyes of the buyers that they're not going to accept products unless they meet some of these minimum process evaluation standards. And that's really the long and the short of it is that we're only trying to provide the service that is being required of our producers and packagers, because we're already in the facilities and already in the locales, and we can do that at a cost-effective price for them.
Further questions? One more from the chair. How do we pay for this program?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there, as Mr. Kelly said, there, I believe there is also some... the term, I don't remember how you said
Mr.
that.
Chair, members of the committee, there is subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and the funds will be dealt with at that stage of the process if the chair and committee determines that this bill should be passed on.
Mr. Chair, the work is paid for by fees that are paid by the people that use the service. So.
Yes.
And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's a grower in the Klamath area who is initiating a program of what he's termed secured storage. It's in a sense a reaction to bioterrorism concerns, but it's basically a secured storage method of distribution where basically the product is being under like lock and key under each step of the process as it goes from the storage shed, which is under lock and key, and then being taken then to the transportation, you know, to the truck. This system which the grower can implement at a minimal cost. It's more of a time hassle than it is actually a cost issue, but for this process, the grower is getting is a dollar more for
85 cents a carton.
85 cents more per carton, which is basically equal to nearly $1 million in net gain during the course of a year. So the costs are small in comparison to the benefit, and having that third-party official verification gives integrity to the process and definitely shows that there is a market for such a service.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 242? We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 240. Whoops. I'll reopen.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay? My name is Lorna Walker, and when I saw that this bill was being presented, I thought, how wonderful, because of the fact that during the summer last year, at numerous markets over the broad area, there was available for purchase produce that was in various ways contaminated. Some of it contained chemicals that were either applied at the wrong time or in excess quantity. Some of it contained foreign substances, such as a petroleum product in a vegetable. Some of it, I can go down the long list. Upon inquiry about this circumstance, I found that there was really no one accepting responsibility for monitoring the processing of these products during the growth process, the transportation process, even through the marketing. And this is quite crucial to the welfare of our general public. When you go to purchase something, if you eat it and it causes you pain for several days, or if it's obviously something that is not well, you can take it back to the store. Well, that's a hardship on them if they don't have someone to take it back to. And the cycle is rather endless. And we have to be very careful of the process so that there is accountability throughout the process of the growth and the presentation of our food products to the public. There's lots of talk of bioterrorism. Well, some of it is just either ignorance or carelessness in handling at some step along the way in the process. And we do need to be accountable and responsible in that process without it causing any undue hardship upon anyone along the way, and without it causing unrecompensed expense. Do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
I'm Lorna Walker, Representative yes. Nelson. Yes.
Walker. Mm-hmm. Ms. Walker, are you talking to, about the enforcement of these laws as relates to farmers' markets?
I don't know the intent of this law. But I would presume that if you are going to have a law in effect, it's going to, if it isn't applied directly, it's going to have a trickle effect through the whole process. I'm not referring to just farmers markets. I'm referring to markets across the broad. I'm referring to products across a broad area. Different families of markets. I'm using the term families in terms of large companies as well as smaller companies. And this is something that we have to be very responsible in. And the same thing applies in terms of of transportation and storage in terms of, you know, if we have seeds and grains, if that process isn't handled very carefully, we can have an infestation of a very broad area of, you know, grain fly, which, you know, looks like dandruff to some people at some stages, and other stages it's a very offensive, you know, hazardous to the health kind of circumstance, which we see evidences of sometimes in the schools. We see evidences in various aspects of the community, which people kind of shun away from without really taking responsibility for what's causing it and how we control and monitor it.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that Ms. Walker understands that what I was not advocate. We already have those laws. They're already in. I mean, we already have standards. If the Department of Agriculture is not enforcing them already, you know, they shouldn't exist. So for us to think today that these laws are new, they're not. We already have standards for how our fruit can be produced, our vegetables, you know, all of that is already part of law. We're not trying to undo those.
We agree.
What I'm talking about is additional burdensome beyond that. Grade products in comparison with competitors. So I just want to be sure I'm not on the record thinking that we don't want any, you know, inspection process, because we have those already. They're already in place. They're enforced. They're required, and to protect you.
Yes, Representative Nelson, I am aware of standards that are in effect, but I also recognize that in some aspects of the process of food coming from the seed through the product through the transportation to the market, there are aspects of that are not monitored and for which people have not accepted accountability. It doesn't mean that we don't have standards, but there is a monitoring process that has to happen at certain stages in order for it to be effective. And I just speak on behalf of the work that's being done. Thank you.
Thank you. Concludes the hearing for Senate Bill 242, and House and Ag Committee is adjourned.